In this hour of Focus 580, we will return to a subject that we have talked about many times before in the past with different guests, with different kinds of perspectives, and that's the politics in the Middle East and very specifically the ongoing conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. And our guest for the program today is Joel Migdal. He is professor of international studies at the University of Washington. And this is an issue that he has been following and writing about for quite a long time. He's the author of a number of books and many articles on the politics in the Middle East. And I just want to mention one, a recent one that bears on this subject. It's titled The Palestinian People, A History, which he co-authored with Baruch Kimmerling. He's a professor of sociology at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. The book is published by the Harvard University Press and has been out now for, I think, about a year. Questions as we talk this morning are certainly welcome. All you have to do to be a part of the program is to pick up the telephone and give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455 is the only thing we ask, and we try to remind people that it helps to, if you can be brief, just so that we can get in as many callers as possible and manage to accommodate as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody who's interested in joining us should feel welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Migdal, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It's good to be there.
We appreciate it. There is much that we could talk about, and I think I would like to try to concentrate on perhaps a bit more recent history, although whatever questions people have, I know that you would do your best to respond. I guess there's a basic point, one of the basic points that I think it is important and that you and your co-author address in the book, and that has to do with the what we might call the historic status of the Palestinian people as a people, because in a lot of the debate about the Middle East, and particularly we're talking about here this conflict, there are people that make the argument that, and particularly this is an argument that's made by Israelis, make this argument that if we talk about Palestinians or we talk about the Palestinian people, and we put that in caps, having some kind of historic claim to this land, they would say, well, you know, there really is no, there are people who would go as far as to say there is no such thing as the Palestinian people, and that claim breaks down then. Now, I think that this is something that you and your co-author have looked at, and in fact that you feel that is not true, that indeed there is an historic entity, and that there is then also the possibility of making historic sort of claims for something called the Palestinian people.
I think in a way that even in Israel, that argument that the Palestinians don't exist, which was made by Golda Meir, the prime minister of Israel, in the 1960s, and voiced by many people since, that claim no longer is seriously made by a significant portion of the population. In other words, that's an issue that has passed from the scene. Now Israelis basically accept that the Palestinians have constructed a nation, have created a nation, have some claims to statehood according to the rules of the modern world. And it really is, I think in the 1990s, really passed from the scene as a serious issue.
Maybe if we could jump again from there to something that is a bit more recent history, but helps us to talk about why it is we are at the point that we are. I'd really like to have you spend some time talking about Oslo and what happened, and particularly why it was that attempt at making a peace here between Israel and the Palestinians was not successful.
Well, Oslo, first of all, brought with it many, many changes that are important today. One of them is the one I just said. It was after Oslo that the Israeli population really was willing to accept the legitimacy of the Palestinian people and of a two-state solution, meaning that the historic territory of Palestine that the British ruled in the early part of the 20th century would be split between the Jewish people and the Palestinian people into two states. So that was a very big accomplishment for Oslo. And also on the Palestinian side, the fact that the Palestinians accepted the legitimacy of Israel, accepted its existence, was a big step forward. And I think that the polls that you see today, which show that about three-quarters of Palestinians and Israelis accept the idea of a two-state solution, accept the legitimacy of the other, is a big, big accomplishment. But Oslo also had a lot of failures, and it was a process that was supposed to take nearly 7 years to complete, and those 7 years turned out to be torturous. And what happened was, instead of building confidence that the other side was going to do its part, each side began to feel during those 7 years that the other side was really using Oslo as a ruse or a ploy. And they lost confidence in the process. And by the year 2000, it really was in shambles. So what you have coming out of Oslo is the idea of we will accept each other, and you have also a kind of blueprint for how to get there. And out of the very end of the process, the Camp David Accords, not the Camp David Accords, but the Camp David negotiations, and the negotiations that followed those in the Middle East, you actually have a plan of what a peace is going to look like. But at the same time, you lost the confidence of the public that you can actually get there.
Is it really clear, and I guess here again it's a point that is often raised on the Israeli side, is it really clear that the Palestinians, enough of the Palestinians, have given up on the idea that they can achieve their what they want by force, and that they could get rid of Israel by force of arms? Is it really true? And as I say, I think this is a point that often Israeli make, is that to their satisfaction, the Palestinians and the Palestinian leadership, I'm not exactly sure what they're looking for, but they haven't said to their satisfaction that we renounce our previous position that said essentially it's our aim to get rid of Israel and the Israelis.
Well, certainly to the Israelis, it's not clear at all. And I said about three-quarters of the population supports that. That quarter that doesn't is very important because it's the one that supplies suicide bombers. It's the one that continues violence and the rhetoric of we will destroy you until you're all out of here. And the lack of resoluteness by the Palestinian leadership to state clearly that, no, we're not going to accept that idea of your being destroyed. We're accepting your presence and a two-state solution. All these have led the Israelis to believe that, in fact, they're not trustworthy, that they're not a partner, that they can't be part of negotiation. And on the other side, the same is true. The fact that the Israelis doubled the number of settlers in the West Bank and Gaza Strip over the years of the Oslo process led the Palestinians to raise the exact same question. Are they really serious? They say they're accepting us, but are they serious? And that's really the nub of the problem. My own view is that both sides really do want to accept a two-state solution, the majority of the people on both sides, and many politicians as well, but they're unwilling to pay the price domestically when it comes to putting down those who are taking a different position.
I think that we tend, and not just here, but in a lot of cases, we tend, when we see opposing forces or opposing groups, we tend to describe them and think of them in kind of monolithic terms. Certainly, one of the things we know about Israel is that it's a society that's divided in a lot of ways. Certainly, politically, it's divided, and there are different people who have different ideas about what the country should be and where it should be headed. So one cannot really talk about the Israelis as if they all believe the same. And so by the same token, I guess you would have to say you can't really also talk about the Palestinians as if all the Palestinians were the same. But I think for a lot of people, particularly people who don't follow the issue closely, it's difficult to understand the makeup of that side of the Palestinians, and particularly of the people who seem to be struggling for who it is that's going to determine the direction, who it is that's going to make the policy vis-a-vis Israel. And I'm hoping that you can perhaps talk a little bit and help us understand a little bit more about just exactly what sort of groups or clusters of people under this big umbrella of the Palestinians there are, and how it is that, you know, who it is that's trying to pull things in either one way or another.
Well, in among the Palestinians, you can imagine a triangle, a kind of three-way struggle for political power. And here are the three groups. The first group is the group that actually holds official power, and that's the old PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, under Yasser Arafat. This is an aging group for the most part. It's an aging leadership. Many of them are well into their 60s and 70s. They were in exile for many, many years in Jordan, Lebanon, and then Tunis at the end before they finally, under the Oslo Accords, returned in 1994. The second and third groups, both are younger. Many of them are in their 40s. They came out of the new universities that opened under Israeli occupation in the 1970s, and they were student leaders at that time. They were heading student politics. That's where they cut their teeth on politics. And then were very active in setting up what we would call civil society, Boy Scout groups and agricultural extension groups, clubs for women, all sorts of things like that. And practically all of them were at some point arrested by the Israelis, and it was in prison that they got to know each other and began to form a cohesive leadership. And there were two groups, one coming from religious universities and one coming from secular universities. The religious, the ones who came from religious universities were the ones who now head Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and the secular ones entered into the Fatah movement, but really as Arafat's group, but really as a kind of younger, challenging leadership. So that's the three sides of the triangle: the young secular group, the young religious group, and the older PLO group. And there's quite a struggle among them on who's going to prevail. For example, the younger group really now has resigned en masse from Arafat's group in protest in the last month, in protest against the lack of reforms in the Palestine Authority and in his kind of lack of vision and movement forward. So there's a lot of tension there among the Palestinians.
When you look at what has been achieved or what has not been achieved by the group, by the old power, the official power group, the older members, the older PLO people, and you ask why it is that they haven't managed to do more for the Palestinian people. I suppose some people would say at best they have been incompetent, at worst they have been corrupt. For their part, they seem to tend to point to Israel and say, look, it's if we haven't been able to achieve what we want, it's not our fault. It's not for lack of trying. It is because Israel and the government, if Israel has done everything it can to prevent us from being successful, that is, it's not, we've been blocked everywhere, and that's the reason we haven't been able to achieve more. And I wonder how you look, obviously those are two extreme sort of positions, but I wonder how you look at that. On one hand, just failure of leadership, and on the other hand, inability to achieve goals because Israel is in the position of getting in the way.
Right. As you expect, it's some of both. The Israelis, particularly since Sharon has come to power, have really made it a point to smash the infrastructure of the Palestine Authority. And it's been very, very difficult to rule. Their records have been hauled away. If you don't have records, basic records in government, it's almost impossible to govern. And the raids that the Israelis have in the various cities after suicide bombing attacks have hauled away records, have hauled away computers, smashed computers, those sorts of things. So there's no doubt that it's very, very hard to rule, given this constant violence and the attempt of the Israelis to smash the Palestine Authority infrastructure. At the same time, there is a real conflict among the leadership about the Palestinian leadership about what's how to rule. Arafat has been accused of corruption and the people under him of corruption. I think there is no doubt that that is going on. And international organizations, his own younger people come to him and say, you know what, you have to have double entry bookkeeping. We have to be able to keep track of what happens to these funds and not go and line people's pockets. And Arafat's response, I don't think explicitly, but what he's kind of the subtext of his response is, you know, did the Chicago political machine under Daley have double-entry bookkeeping? Did Tammany Hall have double-entry bookkeeping? You build a political state by building loyalty, and you do that by rewarding people. Now, that has gotten out of hand. That kind of political machine or political boss kind of mentality has led to a lot of corruption, and I think many, many young, active Palestinians are now saying, you know what, we can blame the Israelis all we want, but this has really become independently a very corrupt regime.
Hmm. What, I have a caller here holding, and I want to get right to them. I promise I won't make them wait further, but just one other question that I would like to raise, and that is the fact that over time, international governments and organizations have proposed giving financial aid to the Palestinians
and have given it,
although I guess the complaint that one often hears from the Palestinian side is that in fact a lot of promises has been made and they have not all been kept, and that in fact a lot of the aid that was promised never materialized, so we're limited in what we can do because we don't have the wherewithal to do it. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that the most of the European countries, which have been big providers of aid and international organizations, came through pretty well, although they've been reluctant recently because they feel that their money has been going into a black hole. Where you've had promises not fulfilled much more often has been from the oil-rich Arab states, which promised and often didn't provide sums of money to get that government off the ground and going. So, yes, there have been promises that haven't been made. On the other hand, there was quite a bit of money filtered in there over the last 10 years or so.
We have a caller in Champaign to talk with. Let's do that. We'll bring him in on line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions. At the time of the first Intifada, I attended a talk one time, and a speaker spoke about the Palestinization of the Druze minority, that they came to identify themselves more with the Palestinians. The second question that I had was about Palestinians, Christians and Muslims who live within Israel and are citizens, about their identity, or are they able to have much influence on the political process there? I understand they're a very, very large minority. Or do they have any influence on the political process that's going on in the West Bank?
Okay. First of all, the Druze are practically, the Druze that you're talking about are practically all citizens of Israel. They're not living in the West, there are no Druze in the West Bank,
right,
or
right,
the Gaza Strip.
Yes.
And now, when you're talking about the beginning of the first Intifada, you're talking about 15 years ago, and that process has not occurred. In other words, the Druze have not really been Palestinianized, I guess would be the word, as much as some people felt might happen back then.
Okay.
And in fact, they continue to be a very, very important part of the entire Israeli security apparatus, both within the Israeli army and also very big role in the Israeli prison system, and guards and so on.
Oh, pardon me, as border guards as well?
Border guards, I'm not sure, but definitely playing a role through most of the security system.
Okay.
So you've had isolated incidents of Druze being associated with anti-Israel action, for example, but it's been really, really isolated.
Uh-huh.
In terms of the larger Palestinian population, it makes up, in Israel, 18 or 19% of the total Israeli population, not including the West Bank and Gaza Strip, just of Israel itself, Israeli citizens, 18-19% are Arab, Palestinian Arab. And they have undergone a lot of changes over the last few years. They have played an intermediary role between Israel and Palestinians in the occupied territories. They definitely have moved up in terms of education, social status over the years. Many of them are independent contractors, professionals, lawyers, teachers, and the like. There definitely has been a Palestinianization. That is, they tend, according to questionnaires and surveys that have been made, they tend very much now to identify themselves as Palestinians. And after a very, very unfortunate incident at the beginning of this intifada in October of 2000, where they were demonstrating and the Israeli security forces killed 13 of them, there has been a kind of radicalization among many of them, a kind of anger that wasn't seen before. Most of them still strongly identify in a civic sense with Israel. They see themselves as Israeli citizens, but are unhappy about the place of the Arab minority within Israel.
Callers, I get at your question, or you want to follow up?
Yes, one thing. I seem to remember reading in that book, Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in a Promised Land, that some security forces in Israel were worried about Israeli Arabs taking part in the political process and sort of harassed them and tried to prevent any distinctively Arab political parties from forming.
Well, you know, in the early years, Arabs in Israel lived under military rule. They could not form Arab political parties. This went on for a long time. There now are Arab political parties. And when Yitzhak Rabin was the prime minister, he basically stayed in power through having them, not officially, but unofficially as part of his coalition. So they played a very, very big role. But there also definitely is a feeling on their part that they're not playing the kind of political role that they could. And as I said, there is anger. You feel it in the streets of the villages and the towns of Arabs in Israel. There's anger. And I think it's something that Israel has to address. It's a very serious, serious issue.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Joel Migdal. He's professor of international studies at University of Washington in Seattle and has been following the politics in the Middle East for a long time. He's the author of a number of books and has contributed to others, has written many articles, and I just do want to mention one, and that is his book, The Palestinian People, A History, which he co-authored with Baruch Kimmerling. He's a professor of sociology at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Something that I continue to struggle to try to understand is what was going on in the fall of 2000 at the time what has come to be called the Second Intifada got underway, because it seemed from the coverage that I had read before that point, at least on the surface, there was a great deal of optimism that things were in the process of talking about peace and trying to work things out between the Israelis and the Israeli government and the Palestinians. Things were starting to look up, and then it seemed that so abruptly things took a very, very serious turn for the worse, and then got worse and worse, and still here we are today. What happened at that point? Were things in fact going as well as they seemed? And what was it that so quickly got us into the second intifada?
Well, things were not going as well as they seemed. As you know, by the mid-1990s, in 1995, an Israeli extremist assassinated Yitzhak Rabin. Mm-hmm. There were then a series of terrorist bombings in Israel, and that brought in a right-wing government under Netanyahu, who really was not committed at all to the Oslo process, said so explicitly, and was not committed to the Palestinians having a state at all. And yet even under Netanyahu, things kind of moved along. There was an important agreement that we called the Y Agreement, which was signed in the Y Plantation, and things were moving. And then when the new Israeli prime minister came to power in 1999, Ehud Barak, he sort of said to the Palestinians, I'm not very interested in you. I'd really rather have peace with the Syrians, and turn to the Syrians. And the Palestinians really began to feel that nothing is going to happen. They were very, very frustrated. Nothing happened with the initiative with the Syrians. And at that point, Barak turned back to the Palestinians and said, okay, I'll deal with you now. And it was here where President Clinton said, okay, let's have a summit meeting and let's settle this thing once and for all. This summit meeting was very controversial. Barak had certain commitments that he had not undertaken, that Israel had signed certain commitments of withdrawal and they had not withdrawn. And Arafat said, I don't want to go to a summit unless he does what he already said he was going to do. But Clinton insisted, and they went to this summit meeting. And there Barak surprised everybody by giving a very, very generous offer compared to anything that the Israelis had proposed before. And it really seemed, that's where I think everybody seemed to get optimistic. It really seemed that they were on the way to something. The Palestinians, however, felt that while it was a much better offer than before, it wasn't good enough. And the summit failed. Nothing was signed. And at that point, tremendous doubt and frustration set in. This was in August now, late July, August of 2000. And the Intifada began at the end of September. So that frustration of kind of years of watching settlements increase by the Jews in the West Bank, of the Israelis not living up to their agreements, and the failure of the summit, I think, led Palestinians to feel nothing ever really was going to happen unless they start putting some pressure on the Israelis. And that was when the Intifada broke out. Surprisingly, even through those first months of the Intifada, when Clinton was still in office and Barak was still in office, they continued to negotiate. And right as Clinton was leaving and President Bush was entering, they came to a basic agreement. But it was too late. There was already an Israeli election campaign. Barak was out of office within a couple of weeks. The new Prime Minister, Sharon, wasn't interested in this agreement at all. And things just continued on this violent level since then.
Let's talk with another caller. This is also someone in Champaign and line number one. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
When you were just talking about the Second Intifada, you mentioned Sharon, and a lot of people, I think maybe they don't know, but I realized that it was Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount during those critical negotiations that sort of derailed, or helped derail them anyway. But anyway, what I'm getting at is, it seems like criticism of Ariel Sharon, to associate criticism of Ariel Sharon with anti-Semitism, as a lot of people do, is like associating criticism of the Klan with being anti-white. I've been told that there's a powerful Jewish lobby, so-called Jewish lobby, that sort of demands allegiance to any Israeli policies of the Israeli government. My question is there really that kind of a lobby in this country that demands this blind acceptance of Israeli policies? And if so, is there another more rational, popular Jewish voice that might encourage U.S. politicians to take a more objective and rational view toward events in the Middle East? Thank you.
There are a lot of questions there. First of all, yes, let me go back to the beginning of what you said. Sharon went up to the Temple Mount, and that clearly was a precipitating event. I don't think it was a basic cause of the Intifada, but it was kind of the match that was put to the straw. And it was a catalyst or a precipitating event, but I think there were larger causes, and if it hadn't happened then, it would have happened shortly. In terms of anti-Semitism, we're seeing over the last 3 years a growth of anti-Semitism, particularly in Europe, but elsewhere as well, that really is shocking for many Jews, and shocking for others as well. In France, statements by officials, acts of vandalism, in the blowing up of the synagogues in Istanbul and Morocco and in Tunisia. So there have been many, many acts of anti-Semitism which have been very, very worrisome. And I don't think it can be denied that the Intifada the anti-Israeli feeling that has come out in many quarters from this Intifada has also been a cover under which old-fashioned anti-Semitism has reemerged.
But
I think that's pretty clear.
Now, anti-Semitism is absolutely and completely wrong. I'm not, trying to defend it at all.
I understand.
What I'm saying is it seems like the anti-Semitism is automatically attached to any criticism of Israel. I mean, nobody should be persecuting Jews or for any reason. But
right. It's very hard at times to disentangle the anti-Semitism, just pure anti-Semitism and anti-Israeli feelings. And often, you're right, anti-Israel statements are simply used as a cover for anti-Semitism. And the opposite is true, too. The Israeli government, trying to deflect criticism, often accuses others of being anti-Semitic when those may just simply be against the policies of Israel. So in terms of the American Jewish community, the American Jewish community is big. It's the biggest Jewish community in the world. That and Israel is both equal about 5 million people, maybe 2% of the American population. They are very well organized. They have a very, very good set of institutions nationally, and including one of the most effective lobby groups called AIPAC, the American Israel PAC. And which definitely lobbies for Israeli policy and has been a big supporter of Sharon policy. But those are certainly not the only voices in the American Jewish community. Just like Israel has an internal debate about these issues, so are there big debates in the United States. I think not quite as vocal as in Israel, but they're there. And there definitely are other groups. Americans for Peace Now is one of them, which have really expressed a very different view from the main lobbying organization, AIPAC.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I have some other callers here. We'll get right to them in a second. A point I want to make sure that I get back to concerns the various groups within the Palestinian movement that are struggling to be able to set the direction of the movement. And you said that basically one can think about it in terms of a triangle. At one point, we have the older leadership, the official power, those people who were in, have been involved maybe with some time with the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization. And then at the other two points of the triangle, we have younger people, people who were educated at universities, and that they break up into those who came out of religious universities, groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and those that came out of secular universities. And what some people seem to be suggesting is that now among these two groups, that there has been a sort of a tilting toward the religious people who came from the religious universities and groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and that if you ask this question, well, what is it that shapes Palestinian identity, that there has been a slippage away from a more secular kind of way of thinking about what it means to be Palestinian to a more religious kind of Muslim identity? And I guess I wonder whether, in fact, you think that that is true.
I think it is. And I think it stems from the same kind of phenomenon that we see in other places around the world that the United States is very worried about with Al-Qaeda and other radical Islamic groups, that they have sounded a note that is appealing to a lot of people who don't have other channels to make their dissatisfaction known. In other words, for a lot of people who have been hurt by globalization and by all sorts of international processes, Al-Qaeda has been a very, very attractive alternative against the existing establishment. And the same thing has happened among the Palestinians. With the PLO or Arafat not really expressing what people want expressed, moving forward and really getting something done, getting an agreement, then the Islamic groups have really provided a kind of attractive alternative. And that doesn't necessarily mean that that's permanent. I think Hamas's support and people looking to Hamas have been up and down processes depending upon whether there really are viable alternatives. I think people are ready to leave that very quickly if there really seem to be something that's going to give them a secure future, a state, dealing with the problems that they're facing day in and day out.
It's something else now. If you ask this question, well, what's in the interest of Israel? Some people would say that, in fact, the Israeli government has been doing an odd sort of thing. That is, they actually would rather not see those on the secular side succeed, because it's easier for them to, if the more religious side and side that may or may not advocate violence is more successful, that's actually more in the interest of Israel, because that it makes it easier for them to say, well, you see, we can't deal with these people. And that and the charge has been made, in fact, that the government of Israel has done what it can to actually cripple a side that maybe would be more interested in taking an approach that was more secular and more democratic, because then if those people succeeded, then they'd actually have to work with them.
Well, I mean, I think that we can't know what's going on inside their heads, but there is something to that charge. The key person who looked like he was going to be the next leader of the Palestinians on the secular side after Arafat, the person who was really capturing the imagination of Palestinians, and also was willing to accept Israel. I mean, he was much more forthright about it than Arafat ever was, that Israel is here to stay. I've learned that. I've grown up here. I know this. They're here to stay, and we've got to make a deal. This is a fellow named Barghouti. Where is Barghouti now? He's on trial and sitting in an Israeli jail. Now, if in fact he's the hope of the future, both for Israel and for the Palestinians, why is he sitting in an Israeli jail? Why are they targeting him and that sort of person, and really, therefore, creating a vacuum among the secular leadership to vie for the Palestinian loyalties?
We have about 10, 12 minutes left. We have some other calls. We'll get right to them. I just want to introduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking with Joel Migdal. He is a professor of international studies at the University of Washington in Seattle and has written a lot about politics of the Middle East. Again, I would just like to mention one recent book that he co-authored with Baruch Kimmerling, who is a sociologist at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. That book is titled The Palestinian People, A History, and it is published by the Harvard University Press. We'll go back to the phones here and believe that our next caller would be in Chicago on line number 4. Hello.
Hi. You know, I've been following the situation for years, and I just don't seem to understand the Arabs. It appears, just starting back from the Barak peace offer, he gave them a very generous offer, and there was simply no counteroffer to that. I mean, how do you do business with people of that nature? And since then, you've had the Intifada, and it, from what I've been reading, it seemed pretty clear that Arafat had that Intifada planned at a particular time, and he was just using the Sharon visit as an excuse. But it just doesn't seem like the Arabs have any indication or have given any indication of attempting to really want to engage in a peace process. And when you hear them talking about that they can only accept, you know, the pre-1967 borders, after you start all these wars that have been going on and have refused numerous peace offers over the 50-year history since the partition, you can't expect to get everything back that you've lost over that time. And it just seems to me they're being unrealistic.
Well, let's get a comment to Professor Migdal. What do you think?
Right. You know, there are a number of points that you raise there, and they're interesting points. The Palestinians felt, look, there's this piece of turf. It's called Palestine. In the early part of the 20th century, it's what the British ruled between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And at this point in the year 2000, we propose that we get 22% of it, and the Israelis get 78%. So in other words, they felt they had made this huge compromise, that they had lost, as you say, and that the losing was reflected in the fact that they're going to get less than a quarter of it. And so when Barak came to Camp David in July of 2000 and gave his historic plan, they said, you know what, that even falls short of the 22%. You're giving us maybe 18 or 16 percent of it. We want to get this at least the 22%. Now, Barak said at that point, this is as good as you're going to get. I'm not going to give you a better deal than this. And then the violence broke out in late September. That Intifada broke out. And guess what? Barak came back with a much better deal. And so in some ways, the lesson was that the violence had created some leverage for them. Now, are they willing to accept any deal? The deal that was put forth at the little resort of Taba, that I made reference to just when Clinton was going out of office and Bush was going into office, that was January of 2001, the Palestinians said, okay, here's a deal. It gave them about 96% of the West Bank. In other words, about not 22%, but pretty close to it, about 20-21% of the West Bank. And there was going to be a land swap. Most other things were pretty well covered. Not everything, but pretty well covered. And at that point, Barak walked out of the negotiations because he was going to be trounced in the elections that were coming up and said, I can't do this. So to say that they were not interested, I think, is an exaggeration. To say that they turned down a good deal, I think, is true. But on the other hand, Barak sweetened the pot after they walked out and did the violence. So I'm not so sure that they're as irrational as might be seen.
Let's go to next caller, line 1 in Champaign. Hello. Caller there, line 1 in Champaign.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I'm in Bloomington.
Oh, my apologies. Go ahead.
About the deal by Ehud Barak, how much would Ehud Barak have to have given Arafat to satisfy him? You say he was in trouble. He couldn't take yes for an answer. Well, just how much would Barack have to give him in order to satisfy him?
Well, as I said, the deal that was struck at Taba was ready to, the Palestinians were ready to accept it. And you know what? That is going to be the deal. If we can ever get past where we are now, the deal that was struck at Taba, which, by the way, was simply reiterated in this new document called the Geneva Accord, which some non-official Israelis, led by Yossi Beilin, the head of one of the just elected the head of a new party in Israel, and Yasser Abed Rabo negotiated. It's the same deal. We know what the peace plan is going to look like, and the Palestinians are ready to accept it, and I think most Israelis are ready to accept it. The problem is we cannot get from this point of violence to where they can sit down with each other and have confidence that the other side is actually going to live up to its part of the deal.
Well, if we have a pending deal that will work, why can't we get the violence stopped? That should be easy. Somebody doesn't want peace. Somebody doesn't want anything but an elimination of the Jews.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. That somebody who doesn't want peace. Why can't we stop the violence? I think there are two answers to this question. One is that on each side, there is about a quarter of the population which thinks that this deal is an historic sellout. The settlers and others in Israel feel that this deal to give the Palestinians a state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip is selling out the Jewish birthright. And on the Palestinian side, Hamas and others, also about a quarter of the population, feel that it would be a sellout for the Palestinians. So these groups have served as veto groups and have been very, very, particularly on the Palestinian side, have been very, very violent and really have kept throwing the wrenches into the machinery. Now, why can't we get from this violence? It's a good question. I think that on both sides, and I said this earlier, both sides, the population has lost confidence that the other side is really going to do it. Yeah, there's a deal on paper, but are they going to live up to it? If you ask the Israelis, will the Palestinians live up to that deal? No, they're not going to live up to it. They're going to try and destroy us. And if you ask Palestinians, will the Israelis live up to it? No. They're committed to these settlements. They'll never move those settlements off the land. They never haven't even moved a single settler yet since 1993 when the Oslo Accord came. So that lack of confidence by the population really makes it very hard to move towards a serious negotiation.
Let's go again. I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's go again to line number two, and this is, again, I believe, Champagne. Hello.
Hello. I just read an article, I think it was in yesterday's Chicago Tribune, and it's called Warping Middle East Judgments by Stephen Heidemann. And it talks about pressure on area studies by Congress, or maybe more by the federal government or by the Bush administration. And I was wondering if you could speak to that. To what extent do you feel your work or your department or your students are pressured by government policies or ideologies or Congress in doing your research or, you know, your, quote, production of knowledge? And then I have another question after that, possibly.
Okay, that's a really good question. It's a very serious question. I am very, very worried about this, and I think Stephen Heidemann has hit the nail on the head. I've had a student, he's a Turkish student, he's a TA for me, teaching assistant, and he said to me, you know, I don't feel that I can express all the analytic perspectives I want in my class anymore. He said, because people are looking at my visa now, and I'm afraid students are going to report me if I say something even mildly controversial to the FBI, and I'm not going to have a visa to study here. I think this is a very serious problem. In addition, there is a bill now in Congress, it's passed the House but not the Senate, which would create an oversight committee for Middle East centers that are federally funded around the country. We have one here at the University of Washington. This is very worrisome to us. Worrisome that the government would have its hand in looking over the shoulder of what academics are doing. Even if the government does nothing, the intimidation factor is huge. And I think this is an extremely, extremely worrisome set of events.
And I just heard, I guess it was last Saturday, an interview with Victor Hansen, who's a classic scholar, with Scott Simon on NPR. And I felt that he was promoting a very simplistic view of the Middle East and the rest of the world as being in a, quote, clash of cultures. So how do you think the kind of work that you do might be useful in getting some understanding across cultures?
And I think I can give you about a minute, unfortunately, because we're just about out of time.
Okay. Well, I'll just say that Victor Hansen is a well-known right-wing popularizer. I've actually assigned some of his materials in my class because they really do are very, very tendentious and polemical writings. And I would say what we have to do is get away from it's us versus them and towards looking at the vast populations like Palestinians, but also others around the world, as people who are really looking for serious ways out of difficult problems. And to them, radical ideologies are appealing, but there could be more appealing non-radical ideologies that would appeal to them. And then we have to sort of say to them, those are out there, and we're going to make them real for you.
We will have to stop there. I want to thank you very much, Professor Migdal, for giving us some
time.
Thank you, David. Our guest, Joel Migdal, is Professor of International Studies at University of Washington in Seattle and is the co-author of the book, The Palestinian People, A History. It's published by the Harvard University Press.